Welcome to Worker Movement, a podcast dedicated to the working class, a podcast dedicated to raising class consciousness. This podcast is for you, for us, for the worker.
The traditional definition of imperialism is that it's the final stage of capitalism, where corporate countries basically fight over the resources of external states for the benefit of finance capital. The goal is to expand capitalism and return profits to the motherland, whether they be money or resources or something else. Profits in this context is surplus value derived from labor exploitation. This typically entails colonization and colonialism, but doesn't need to. This definition was framed in the early 1900s by Vladimir Lenin. With the development of globalization, finance capital can partake in imperialism differently today than at the turn of the 20th century. Institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, which are both children or under the oversight of the United Nations, are extensions of finance capital. Colonialism can now be done without war.
And it's arguably the best form of it because it relies on the least amount of violence from the homeland, right?
It's not acute violence, right?
It's not acute violence. It's chronic violence. It's the neoliberal imperialism, which didn't exist when Lenin talked about it. And it's really important that we say this because there's a bunch of scumbag textbook leftists who don't understand that when theory is written 100 years ago, things change a little bit. And instead of needing a barrel of a gun, power is derived from now, like the barrel of a gun in some sense, but also how big your war chest is in your bank, or how much credit you can lend, how much technical expertise you can provide a nation.
Instead of violence being through a gun, it's now chronic violence. Exploitation is created through chronic violence rather than acute violence.
Yeah, the state is still producing violence. And in the 1900s, you had both the state doing acute violence with guns, chronic violence with things like allowing mining towns. In some cases, that chronic violence was accelerated much faster and was more like acute violence than we see today. Because life expectancy was lower, right? The amount of damage done to children was bigger, so it was in the media. But a lot of the violence nowadays, like just pure exploitation, like wage theft, right? Pollution, the things that reduce your life expectancy, the chronic violence, are basically normalized as being part of the system. And that's what we want to give to other countries in the form of imperialism. We want to give you that opportunity.
We want to create debt servitude in the external state so that they are bound to act the way we want through their own basically financial interests rather than having boots on the ground controlling the locals through literal military force.
And in the areas that we can't get them to listen to us through the World Bank, we have to then send in the boots on the ground. And that's actually the struggle of South America. And that's the cycle of South America. We've tried to institute policy changes through the World Bank or the IMF, and then they don't listen to us, apparently. Then we have to send in our troops, or, you know, CIA-backed troops, at least, to get them back in power. And the reason why South America is so important is because it's the shortest distance between natural resources and us. And we have failed to colonize South America.
And that failure is basically a failure of the standard mode of operation of imperialism, which is you would do it with boots on the ground. That hasn't worked. So instead, we're trying this basically debt servitude model where we try and make countries beholden financially to U.S. interests so that these countries lose their autonomy. They lose their ability to self-determine. And basically, state violence is enacted through chronic violence, through debt servitude. And the population is effectively just transferring resources from their country to the motherland, to the imperial core.
Yeah, we do that through all types of different methodologies. Again, we have loans, we have restricting money, right? Like you see in some quote-unquote dictator areas. We have giving free trade agreements to some countries. We have the ability to partner and trade other expertise. We'll have the UN come in for some reason and monitor elections, make sure they go the way that the U.S. wants. It's a really interesting form of imperialism because if the U.S. just started north and worked its way down starting 100 years ago and just kept a steady colonialization of it, it probably would have had South America done already.
You would have an entire country of basically like soft neoliberal parliamentary Iraq-like governmental structures that are beholden to U.S. interests, and you'd be able to mine all the lithium from Brazil you want.
Yeah, basically, after World War II, the U.S. sort of stop that. Argentina fell in dictatorship. Brazil became fucking Brazil. And then the U.S. sort of lost this. And we're not advocating for this. What it's setting us up for, though, is that the U.S. foreign policy with boots-on-the-ground imperialism, the acute violence, hasn't actually followed what's needed to complete the colonization, which is actually transferring U.S. citizens into those countries to finalize that with the traditional route with boots on the ground. It's also failed to maintain imperialism in the form of bank loans because, for better or for worse, the U.S. has a 4 to 8 year cycle on presidencies and nobody actually follows through on any one plan. Because this takes, no matter what you do, 20, 40, 60 years of actual colonialization for this to happen. And what I mean by that is you don't just put a Starbucks in the middle of, like, Nicaragua and hope that, oh my God, it's going to inspire all the local coffee shops to start becoming Starbucks. That's not how that works. But that's what the U.S. hopes it works. It tells you that on paper, but that's not how it actually works.
So two examples of this historically. One is Cuba. The U.S. has imposed an embargo on Cuba, which is a form of debt servitude in a way by withholding resources from Cuba. And the idea was that through this embargo, you could cripple Cuba's, I don't know, ability to influence international trade, or, like, I don't even know anymore. Like, why do we care what Cuba does or doesn't do?
Because it's a 60-year-old war that we fought and lost or won. I don't know. Nobody alive today that doesn't have dementia remembers what's going on.
So that's an example of the U.S. being cognizant of this basic plan by, we're going to financially cripple this country and make them beholden to our interests. So if at any moment Cuba just wanted to say, hey, we're willing to play ball, we'll do whatever you want, the U.S. lifts restrictions, and suddenly Cuba is now exporting their resources to the U.S. in exchange for not having an embargo. That's the trade.
It's also a really weird torture, too. It's the thought process that you could weaponize someone's economy against them. They tried doing it in Iran with the embargo. They tried doing it in South America, everywhere, where you pretend that by hurting the peasant, the worker, with embargoes, they're going to turn the pitchforks against the king and demand a change in leadership, which isn't what happens. You just make people suffer. It's a really odd methodology.
The other historical example is Winston Churchill's enactment of basically famine in India around the World War II-ish area, where, like, literally nobody cares that, like, millions of people died in India because it was serving the white motherland.
Millions of Bengals died. They just dumped grain in the water, and the argument was that if they capture it, the Japanese will sink our boats, but that's all bullshit. You tell me you couldn't move your boats through there? You just wanted to starve people.
So that's kind of a quasi-debt servitude thing, too, where in order for us to help you by providing food, you need to completely cave to our interests, which is exploitation. Britain, the UK, whatever the fuck they're called, wanted India's labor.
And cotton. And tea. I mean, literally. India, you could not buy your cotton grown in India from an Indian farmer. It was illegal until, like, the 60s. Some wild thing like this.
So those are both examples of this new imperialism where it doesn't require actual boots-on-the-ground troops, but you can basically control a native population through economic means. And this is not something that was envisioned in the early 1900s when imperialism was initially defined.
You know, it's because neoliberalism really took off in that post-World War II, where we saw that corporations gained power and then convinced governments that they should be partners after they saw the success in basically fascist Italy, and then fascist Argentina. I mean, the last thing that the dictator of Argentina did in the 80s was nationalize all its debts, which is why it's had a crippled economy since, like, the 60s.
And who installed that dictator?
Oh, the United States. There's an Argentina coup d'etat in 1976. Henry Kissinger made sure he helped out. In fact, Henry Kissinger recommended to the armed forces that they destroy their opponents quickly before outcry over human rights abuses grew in the United States. This is part of the covert United States involvement in regime change Wikipedia page. And here's the actual literal list of things. 1948-1960s, Italy. 1949, Syrian coup d'etat. 1949-1953, Albania. 1953, the Iranian coup d'etat. 1954, Guatemala coup d'etat. 1956-57, Syrian crisis. 57-58, Indonesian rebellion. 1959-2000, assassination attempts on Fidel Castro. 59, Cambodia. 60, Congo. 61, Cuba, Bay of Pigs. 61, Cuba, Operation Mangu. 61, Dominican Republic. 63, South Vietnamese coup d'etat. 64, Brazilian coup d'etat. 66, Indonesia. 66, Ghanaian. 71, Bolivia. 70-73, Chile. 76, Argentina. 79 El Salvador, or Salvadorian. Yeah, Salvadoran. 79 to 89 Afghanistan Operation Cyclone. 80 to 92 Angola. 81 to 87 Nicaragua. 1982 Chad. 1996 Iraq coup d'etat. 2012 to 2017 Syria.
So the U.S. has a long, long history of basically enacting like imperialism without fucking boots on the ground through state violence.
Through state violence. But this is actually acute violence by us giving weapons to or intel or advice to fighters to overthrow their government. So these are literal attempts at like overthrowing governments with literal force without using U.S. forces beyond a little bit of, you know, guidance.
And what was importantly not included in the list you just read was the Korean War, which was literal imperialism with standard troops that the U.S. arguably lost. The Vietnam War, same thing, actual war the U.S. lost. And you have the Iraq War in the 2000s, and then the Afghanistan War in the 2000s that just recently ended. So that list included a lot of countries that I think most people are completely unaware of as having been puppets of the U.S. basically foreign policy regime.
And the whole argument on this podcast right now is that the U.S. has two flavors now of imperialism, and they suck at both of them.
Yeah, we have objectively failed at the boots-on-the-ground imperialism for the last 70 years. It functionally is not effective. Whether you like agree with it politically, irrelevant. It does not functionally work.
What this leads us to, then, is if the United States isn't good at imperialism through colonialism, traditional troops on the ground, and then moving in like U.S. populations to convert the population to a Western culture, and they're also not good at using the IMF to enforce debt servitude on people because we just can't maintain that posture for so long, or we go in so aggressively that the population says, fuck you guys, we're done, because we don't have a 30-year plan, we have a 5-year plan. It's just greed, right? Pure greed. Now, I'm not arguing again for the neoliberal policies. I'm just saying these are what the failure modes are.
The U.S. has arguably been unable to win the hearts and minds of any foreign entity.
Anybody.
For a long-ass time, either through military force or through this financial, covert, political imperialism. We're incompetent as a U.S. country at this.
The question then remains, what was Afghanistan?
Afghanistan was originally just, I think, a preemptive war, a war of revenge, because they did 9/11 and finance capital was victimized by that. And I think that's about as far as anybody thought about it. I think there might have been some hope of extracting resources from Afghanistan once upon a time, but that, I think, quickly faded away when the U.S. failed to industrialize the country in any way, shape, or form and seemed content to just periodically kill civilians from the sky.
We talked about this before. I don't understand the Afghanistan, because if it wasn't for it wasn't about nation building. It wasn't about changing them culturally, or the Taliban wouldn't have come back so fast. Because culturally, you would get rid of the quote-unquote Sharia law, everybody's afraid of. But really, it's just a conservative law base that's no different than conservative Christians in, you know, Texas.
You would militantly impose whatever you wanted your will to be.
And if the U.S. would have just started in anywhere but the capital and just built a metropolis there, it would have been a completely different country in methodology. They would have just paved roads instead of bombing the roads, which is what China's going to do, by the way. China's going to pave roads on the western side of that country and be able to start extracting resources in probably 10 years. No questions asked.
So China is typically thought of as not an imperialist country, but if we use our definition, they are absolutely enacting imperialism. They're just not enacting it through acute violence.
And they won't. And it may not even be chronic violence in the sense that they may actually increase the life expectancy in that country by not bombing them and giving them food, water, and jobs. Will it be actual, you know, communist utopia? No. Will it be exploitive? Sure will be. Will it be better than what the U.S. brought to Afghanistan? Yes, absolutely. And that is a difference. And that, I think, will be primarily what changes the scope of Afghanistan's future.
So China will return profits from their incursion into Afghanistan as a result of building roads and whatever. They'll extract resources that will then be used by the imperial core, but they will likely do that without enacting state violence on the local population.
And or it won't be at to the same magnitude. Again, we talk about the IMF goes in and give out loans, and then it's just brutal. It's just they brutalize the country for being poor.
You run into a situation like El Salvador where they literally don't have a currency that's viable, and you're stuck using the US dollar and fucking Bitcoin because you don't have any fucking money. You
don't have a fiat currency. Or Argentina, where they're literally seizing their boats at port as collateral to pay their debts. You know, we talk about how Afghanistan wasn't nation building. We failed at colonialism. We failed at imperialism with boots on the ground. We failed at imperialism with building out businesses there, because that's the only way the U.S. thinks about helping people is through stealing resources or, I guess, making you a franchise, I guess. Let's talk then about how we left Afghanistan real quick. Nobody cares about Afghanistan. The news does, because they need shit to talk about. The paper is part of the news because they just need to sell stuff. The bootlickers do because for some reason the troops are dishonored or some dumb shit. But, like, do you and I care about Afghanistan? I care about the humanitarian issues there, but most people aren't going to see any more brutality or less brutality with the Taliban there.
My material conditions are completely unchanged as a result of the U.S.'s withdrawal. I am more likely to be killed by some psychopath right-wing terrorist while I'm grocery shopping than I am by a ISIS-K terrorist doing an attack on the homeland.
Yep, that's exactly it. I'm not going to give Trump credit, nor will I give Biden credit for what the fuck happened, because it's just straight-up ridiculous about what all to get out of there. But we're out of there. Trump made this weird deal, I think, to just troll if he lost the election. Yeah.
I think it was fundamentally a deal to fuck over Biden should he lose, like a ticking time bomb. Should he lose,
yep.
And if he wins, he just says, fuck it, I do what I want.
Do what I want, right? And interesting article on Slate, where Slate was like basically saying that if Biden would have listened to his advisors and the military, we'd still be in Afghanistan. So they paint this bootlicking story about Biden where he actually may have done the right thing. He may have just said, well, fuck, if we don't get out of there by August 30th or 31st, I don't know how many days are in August. 30 days has November, April, June, and November. So I think 31 days in August. Then the Taliban would resume fighting, and which meant we would be in war again, and that's what the generals want. Because the generals only exist for war, and they're career generals. And the military-industrial complex only exists for war, and they're career weapons seller. So they really have no incentive for peace, so all of their suggestions are biased in the worst type of way for acute violence. Because there's nobody in the military who says, you know, if we were to build schools, they wouldn't kill us in 20 years. Because that's a whole generation, everybody. That's what it comes down to. You need generational changes. It's not just, oh, in 2 years, they're going to love us and go use, I don't know, McDonald's McFlurries as their currency. That's not going to happen.
The U.S. doesn't have a unit of people like the military that basically says, hey, what if instead of killing the civilians, what if we did this? Because then we could extract more resources. That doesn't exist as a government function. It's delegated to corporations.
Yep.
So, like, Biden doesn't have anybody to ask that's like, hey, what do you want to do here? Because no corporation gives a shit about Afghanistan. They don't have any profit motive there. The generals just want to perpetuate war, and it's like, well, no to that, and the corps don't care, so let's just leave.
Most of Afghanistan's tribal, so they don't have a currency. I don't think people actually understand the difference in city versus, like, rural tribal areas. Like, they don't have the same type of capitalistic tendencies in rural third world countries because they don't have shops. They kind of work together to make sure everybody has what they need to survive. So when you talk about neoliberal foreign policy here, you can't win them over with guns and you can't win them over with currency. It's not how it works. You only win them over by, like, literally building something that they don't have for them to use.
By actually helping them.
Yeah, like a World Cup stadium. Let's bring the World Cup to Afghanistan. Because the only people that can use currency then, it's like the capital. Like nobody has money unless you're like a mercenary. Like, it's like, I don't think people actually comprehend this because they lived in capitalism for so long they don't actually know what it's like to exist, you know, where you don't have anything.
Like, where you're not concerned about what the exchange rate with the euro or the Japanese currency is on a daily basis. You don't know what the exchange rate is? No, I don't give a shit because I heard goats.
Right. I just lost a kid to a U.S. airstrike. Back to the idea, though, that the U.S. have failed at imperialism everywhere. The real question, though, is for us, as a local worker, we've already said our material conditions don't change, which really means that we don't have any need when it comes to external imperialism at all. So what does affect us as a worker is when imperialism happens in the reverse way, or when we begin to exploit the workers of another country by convincing them to take, I guess, the resources of the local population. Whereas capitalism doesn't want to pay anybody a fair wage, so they do everything they can to suppress wages. And I am not saying that we should close borders. What I'm saying is that the U.S. exploits H-1B visas by trying and attempting to taking the best students or workers that a country has and bring them here to the United States to exploit them at a lower wage continuously. And they hold over their head a green card. And they hold up their H-1B visa extensions. They make it almost impossible for them to stay. But they exploit them at the exact same time by dangling this carrot in front of them that they get to stay. What happens is something that's almost akin to reverse colonialism, where you bring over such a large population that they begin to dominate the local workforce and the local population that lives there. And then what happens is you end up with then existential revolts in the original population, in which they're upset and angry with the H-1Bs or the migrant workers or whatever happens to be the flavor of the month of exploitation, because the quote-unquote fabric of their community is changing. They are now the minority worker in that area because capitalism has been exploiting a certain group of workers continuously and pushing them to the side. And that literally happens in all areas of the United States in every sector. It's really big in the tech sector, engineering sector, in which H-1B visas come over and they exploit it for 3 or 4 years, and then all of a sudden they stop getting supported by their company and they cycle through another person. It is pure exploitation.
The same general premise has also happened with manufacturing, and that's why you see stuff like NAFTA and the TPP. It's an attempt to place restrictions on the value of American workers while still enabling the exploitation to happen externally. So if I want to build a car, it's cheaper to do it in Mexico, but that harms the U.S. workforce. And that's the problem with all this free trade stuff, is that the way it's structured in capitalism is that you want to make the car as cheaply as possible, and that will harm the U.S. workers, but capitalism does not care.
Your boss gave away your job. They found a way to play the game. If it's a quote-unquote undocumented or illegal alien, that's a low-paid job, they chose to circumvent workers, like laws that protect workers in the United States, by hiring people and paying them a lower wage. That undocumented worker deserves the same amount of pay as everybody else, but they don't get paid as much, they don't get the health care, they don't get the retirement, they get purely exploited, and then they have you blame it on them. Pure exploitation. The H-1B visa applicants that come over here, pure exploitation. And again, they don't get sponsored after 3 or 4 years, or they get sent back. It's completely disruptive to their families and the neighborhoods around them. It's actually fairly disruptive for the way that capitalism exploits other countries by bringing people here almost against their will, but because it's a better way of living than what they currently have, but it's not as good as it should be. I don't really know how to wrap this part of it up because it's pretty nuts.
So instead of having the U.S. go to a foreign state, colonize, and then enact colonialism on the local population to send the spoils of this exploitation back home, the U.S. has created an immigration system in which people will literally migrate to the U.S. to be exploited because it is better than what their homeland provides.
On purpose.
So the U.S. doesn't even have to do anything from an imperialism perspective to optimize exploitation. They just open their borders, undocumented people come in who are exploited, and capital does not give a shit. That's why the immigration problem will never be resolved, because capital benefits by having cheap labor, and nobody gives a shit about the working class. So this is maybe a third form of imperialism that the U.S. is doing basically in the homeland.
What we're trying to work through on this theory is a reverse colonialism perspective. And we don't say it in a xenophobic way. We don't say it in a nationalist way. We say it in a way that there are people who respond negatively, or people who respond with hatred because they see the fabric of their world around them changing, their material conditions changing, and they have no control over it. we know that limited resources makes people panic and scared. We know that that's where a lot of fear and hate comes from. That's where racism comes from. That's where homophobia comes from. It's basically all this hatred, the xenophobia comes from the other, you know, hatred of the other, because of limited resources. And when people start to see their resources become scarce, they're going to react in that way.
So our general definition of imperialism is an attempt to spread capitalism and return profits to the motherland through a strict enforcement of resources, whether that's boots on the ground, whether that's debt servitude, or whether that's by mangling worker constructs in your own country to be more exploitive. That is functionally how the U.S. is enacting imperialism, to exploit and return profits to the ruling class.
You know, we rattled off earlier a bunch of countries the U.S. dabbled in with traditional imperialism. We know Afghanistan may mark the last of traditional imperialism, especially that was envisioned by Lenin in the 1900s. Because the art of imperialism has progressed, it no longer requires boots on the ground. Again, we talked about how it can debt servitude, just harvesting as much resources as possible. Afghanistan started as a preventative war, maybe? We invaded Afghanistan not for the purpose of exploiting resources at first or the natives, but it seemed to turn out that way in the end, which was just a failed form of colonialism, which is just occupation. We just were an occupying force that did nothing besides destroy. And again, our definition of imperialism has now shifted to being broader. It includes things like boots on the ground. New imperialism can include the World Bank, the IMF, any place that has loan or chronic violence against it. And additionally, it also means that it can exploit workers by convincing them to come here to be exploited, because it's better than being exploited in their motherland. But in all of this, the state is creating violence in either acute or chronic way, and the workers always suffer.
For future episodes and to learn more about the worker movement, join us at workermovement.com.